6. Working with those men was as pleasant as working on the rock gang had been miserable. The labor was heavy at times, lifting and carrying massive chests and strong boxes full of documents, but we used intelligence to plan the work instead of rushing at it with impatient brutality. And we were patient with one another, too. The work was shared fairly, and rather than whipping and shouted orders, there was joking and conversation. Sometimes about the ancient scrolls and records we were handling, sometimes about the siege, the latest attack or fire, or anything under the sun. It was an education in itself to work with these men. I knew that. But I was deeply troubled by much they said. While we were with Reba and the others, our talk was harmless. But most of the day, the priests and their slaves were busy with their ritual duties at the shrine and the senate, and having seen he could trust us to do the work with scrupulous care, Reba left us unsupervised. So while we were in the old repository under the west wall, figuring out what we had to deal with, how to move the decaying boxes and fragile scrolls without damaging them, we were on our own, 7 slaves, in an ancient, thick-walled temple. Nobody to hear us. There, Meman, Tatter, and I enter, talked as I had never heard men talk. Now I understood why Avera spoke of the modern writers as evil influences. My companions were always quoting Denios, Caspro, Retica, and other new poets and philosophers I'd never heard of. And everything they quoted, though much of the poetry was beautiful beyond any I knew, seemed to be critical, destructive, full of fierce emotions, pain, anger, dissatisfied longing. It confused me very much. The Rock Gang were brutal men, but they would never question their place in the system, and would think it childish to ask why one man should have power and another none, as if fate and the gods cared for our questions and opinions, as if all the great structure of society the ancestors had left us could be changed at a whim. My companions here, more refined in their manners than many nobles, and honest and mild in daily life, were in their talk and thought shamelessly disloyal to their houses and to Itra itself, our city under siege. They talked of their masters disrespectfully, contemptuous of their faults. They had no pride in the soldiers of their house. They speculated about the morals even of the senators. Tatter and Ienter thought it possible that some senators, secretly in league with Kasikar, had deliberately sent most of the army south so that Kasikar could take Itra. I listened to days of this kind of talk without saying anything, but protest and anger grew in me. When Tatter, who was not even an Itran but came from north of Asayan, began to talk about the fall of our city not as a disaster but as an opportunity, I couldn't stand it any longer. I burst out at him. I don't know what I said. I raged at him as faithless, traitorous, ready to destroy our city from within, even as the enemy besieged the walls. The other young men, Meman's students, began to pour indignation and mockery onto me. But Tatter stopped them. "Gavir," he said, "I'm sorry to have offended you. I respect your loyalty. I ask you to consider that I too am loyal, though not to the house that bought me, or to the city that uses me. My loyalty is to my own people, my own kind, and however I may talk, never think that I'd urge any slave to rebel. I know where that leads." Taken aback by his apology and his earnestness, embarrassed by my own outburst, I subsided. We went on with our work. For a while, Meman's students shunned and snubbed me, but the older men treated me just as before. The next day, when Ienter and I were taking a coffer to the shrine in a little handcart we had devised to carry the fragile relics, he briefly told me Tatter's history. Born free in a northern village, he had been captured as a boy by raiders and sold to a household in the great city of Asayan, where he was educated. When he was 20, there had been a slave revolt in Asayan. It was savagely repressed. Hundreds of men and women slaves had been slaughtered, and every suspect branded.
"You've seen his arms,"
Ianter said. I had seen the terrible ridged scars, and thought they were from a fire, an accident.
"When he says his own people,"
Ianter told me,
"he doesn't mean a tribe or a town or a household. He means you and me."
It made little sense to me, for I couldn't yet conceive of a community greater than the walls of Itra, but I accepted it as a fact. Meeman's students continued to ignore me most of the time, but without malice, I was much younger than the youngest of them, in their eyes a half-educated boy. At least they trusted me not to betray them by reporting seditious conversations, for they talked freely in my presence. And though I was shocked by much they said, and silently despised them as hypocrites who feigned loyalty to masters they hated, I found myself listening, just as I had listened, disgusted, repelled, but fascinated, to the sexual talk of some of the men in the barrack at home. And so, the eldest of Meeman's students liked to tell about the Barnavites, a band of escaped slaves living somewhere in the great forests northeast of Itra. Under the leadership of a man named Barna, a man of immense stature and strength, they had formed a state of their own, a republic in which all men were equal, all free. Each man had a vote, and could be elected to the government, and diselected, too, if he misgoverned. All work was done by all, and all goods and game shared in common. They lived by hunting and fishing, and by raiding rich people's chariots and the traders' convoys that went to and from Asayan. Villagers and farmers in the whole region supported them and refused to betray them to the governments of Kasikar and Asayan, for the Barnavites generously shared their loot and bounty with their neighbors in those lonely districts, who, if not slaves, were bondsmen or freedmen living in dire poverty. And so drew a lively picture of the Barnavites' life in the forests, answerable to no master or senator or king, bound only by freely given allegiance to their community. He knew stories of their daring attacks on guarded wagon convoys on the roads and merchant ships on the Rassi, and the clever disguises they used to go into towns, even into Kasikar and Asayan, to trade their loot for things they needed in the market. They never killed but in self-defense, and so said, or, if a man came upon their hidden realm deep in the forest, then he must either pledge his life to live as a free man with them, or die. They never took from the poor, and even from rich farms took only the harvest, never the seed grain. And the women of the farms and villages didn't fear them, for a woman was welcome among them only if she joined them of her own free will. Tatter read a book or left the room when Anso got launched on these stories. Once or twice he burst out, calling the Barnavites a mere band of thieving runaways. His scorn for them made me wonder if they had something to do with the slave revolt for which he and other slaves in Asayan had suffered. Ianter derided the stories more mildly as impossible romances. I agreed with him, for the idea that a band of slaves could live as if they were masters, turning the age-old sacred order upside down, could only be a daydream. But still, I like to hear these idols of forest liberty, for the words liberty, freedom, had come to have a presence, a radiance in my mind, dominating it like the great bright stars I used to see on summer nights in Venta, and which I often looked up to see, fainter and farther, from the dark city. We were at leisure evenings in the dormitory, and the priests allowed us oil for our lamps. I read Denio's Transformations, which Tatter lent me, and that was a great discovery to me. It was like that dream I had had of finding rooms in a house that I had not known were there, where I was made welcome among wonders, and greeted by a golden animal. Denios, the greatest of poets, all my companions said, had been born a slave. In his poems, he used the word liberty with a tenderness, a reverence, that made me think of my sister when she spoke of her beloved. And Meeman had a battered little pocket manuscript of Caspro's Cosmologies, which he said went with him everywhere. He encouraged me to read it. I found the poem disturbing and strange, and understood very little of it, but sometimes a line would take me by the heart, the way his song had that first night. I was allowed to run across the city to see my sister for an hour. It was hot September weather. Sallow did not look very well, her body and legs swollen with her pregnancy, her face drawn and tired. She hugged me and asked all about the priests and the other slaves and our work, and I talked the whole time, and then had to run back to the shrine. A few days later, Avera sent word to me that Sallow's child had been born at 7 months and had lived only an hour. We could not bury in the slave cemetery by the river, for it was outside the walls. During the siege, the bodies of slaves who died were burned in the fire towers, as if they were citizens. Their ashes mingled with those of free men in the waters of the Ash Brook, which rose by the fire towers and ran out through a narrow pipe under the walls to join the Nisus, and then the moor, and then the sea. I stood in the autumn dawn at the fire towers by the brook with a few of the people of Archimand. Sallow was not well enough yet to come to the baby's funeral, but Iamer said she was in no danger. I was allowed to go see her after a few days. She was thin and tired-looking, and she wept when she hugged me. She said in her soft, tired voice, "If he'd lived, you know, they'd have traded him as soon as they could. If they could. I heard that one house traded a slave baby for a pound of meal. Nobody wants a new mouth in a siege. I think he knew it, Gav. Nobody really wanted him to be alive. Not even me." "What?" She didn't finish her question, but opened her hands in a small, desolate gesture that said, "What could he have been to me, or I to him?" I was shocked at how my people at Archimand looked. They were all bone-thin, with the same weary look Sallow had, the siege face. Visiting the schoolroom, I found my young pupils pitifully skinny and listless. Children are the first to die in famine. We at the shrine were eating twice as well as most people in the city. Sallow was delighted to see my good health, and wanted me to tell her about the food we got, the priest's fish pond, their carefully guarded flock of chickens that gave us eggs, and now and then a bit of meat or a soup, their garden of holy herbs, which included a good many lay vegetables, the gifts of grain to the ancestors, which fed the descendants of the ancestors. I was ashamed to talk about it, but she said, "I love to hear about it. Do the priests have olives? Oh, I miss olives more than anything." So I told her we had olives sometimes, though in fact I hadn't tasted one for months. I saw Sotur just before I left. She, too, looked listless, her beautiful hair gone dry and dull. She greeted me gently, and I said, without knowing I was going to say it, "Sotur Io, will you give me a quarter bronze? I want to buy Sallow some olives."
"Oh, Gav, there haven't been any olives for months," she said.
"I know where to get them." She looked at me with big eyes. After a moment, she nodded. She went off and came back with a coin, which she pressed into my hand.
"I wish there was more I could do," she said.
So she made my first begging an easy thing. For a quarter bronze, which would have bought a pound of them last year, the black marketer gave me 10 wizened olives. I ran back with them to Archimand and gave them to Iamer for Sallow, who was in the silk rooms. I was long overdue getting back to the College of Priests, but Reba didn't say anything, perhaps because he saw I was in tears. Reba was a gentle man with a serene mind. Sometimes he talked a little with me, telling me about the worship of the ancestors in the shrine, which was carried out as much by the priests' slaves as by the priests. He He made me feel the dignity of that life, and the peaceful beauty of the ever-repeated round of rites and prayers, on which the welfare, the very being of the city depended. I think he saw the possibility that I might be given by my house to the college, and it flattered me that he wanted me. I could imagine living there as a priest of the shrine, but I didn't want to live anywhere but Archimand, near my sister, or do anything but what I had been brought up all my life to do, to learn so that I could teach the children of my house. We were drawing near the end of our job. The ancient documents had been moved to the vaults under the forefathers' shrine, and all we had to do now was sort and store them, work which, in fact, could be drawn out almost indefinitely, for many of these old scrolls and annals were unidentified and ought to be read and labeled and listed, as well as cleaned, preserved from insects, and given proper storage. Our houses weren't eager to have us back. We were only extra mouths in a famine, and the priests and their slaves were glad to have us do the work. In fact, they couldn't have done it without us. I'd been surprised to discover that all seven of us, even I, were much better educated than the priests of the college. They knew the ancestral rites, but very little history or anything else, not even the history of the rites. We were finding all kinds of interesting documents, lives of great men of Itra from the earliest days, prophecies, records of civil and foreign wars, and alliances with other cities, all of which fascinated me, drawing me back to my dream of writing a history of all the city-states. I was content to be burrowing among the old scrolls and parchments down in the silent vaults, under the silent, dying city. "What a comfort the past is," Meeman said, "when the future offers none." Burning the bodies of those who died of starvation went on night and day now down by the ashbrook. The smoke of the pyres rose and mixed with the mists of autumn, and made a pall over the roofs. Sometimes the smell was the smell of burnt roasting meat, and my mouth would water with hunger and sick revulsion. Outside the north walls, the enemy was preparing a huge earthen ramp on which they could bring their siege engines right up to the parapet. The city guardsmen threw paving stones down among the workers, but they swarmed like ants, and their archers shot at any man who showed himself along the walls. Our archers saved those arrows pulled from dying men and made their own from any tree within the walls, even the old sycamores. Unrest ran through the Senate and was shouted in the squares by orators. Why had Itra been so unprepared for attack, without weapons stockpiled, without sufficient food stored, her armies far away? Were there traitors among the senators? Lovers of Kasakar? Men said the Senate refused to open the gates because they wanted Itra to starve, to die before it was surrendered. To some this was noble and courageous, to others a vile betrayal. Rumors of unfair distribution of food now ran wild, true or not. Black marketers whose supplies ran out were murdered on the suspicion of withholding food. A merchant's house was attacked and torn down by a mob who believed he was hoarding. They found nothing but a half barrel of dried figs hidden in the slave's barrack. There were constant stories of grain being hidden under the Senate House, under the shrine of the forefathers. That came too close to home. The priests of the college went in terror for their fish pond, their garden, their poultry, their lives. They begged for guards to be set around the shrine, and 10 men were put on duty. They couldn't have done much if a mob had stormed the shrine, but its sanctity still defended it, and us. It was mid-October. Life hung in a kind of dead lull, which we all felt preceded the end. Within a few days, either the assault on the north wall would begin and would be successful, or a mob out of control would open one of the gates, trying to escape before the slaughter and the burning. Or, conceivably, the Senate would vote to surrender the city in hopes of avoiding total destruction. And then, the thing we had lost all hope of happened. At daybreak, fog and smoke hanging heavy in the streets, over the enemy camp, along the Nisus, there came a sound of alarms, shouting, bugles signaling, the neighing of horses, the clash of arms. The armies of Ytrah had come home at last. All morning we heard the noise of battle outside the walls, and those allowed on the walls and roofs could watch it. We slaves were locked into the compound of the shrine, and could only beg for news from those who ran past the gates. Late in the morning, a great troop of city guards marched through the square, stopping before the shrine for the blessing of the ancestors. They were all afoot. Every horse in the city had been slaughtered for food long since, and there was a poor, lank look about them, their arms, their clothes, their gaunt faces, as if they were beggars pretending to be soldiers, or were the ghosts of soldiers. But the ancestors blessed them through the priests' voices, and they marched on down Long Street to the river gate. They marched in silence, no sound but the rhythmic clink of their weapons. Then, for the first time in 6 months, the gate was flung open, and the Ytran guard burst forth in a sortie, surprising the besiegers from the rear as they faced our armies. This much we heard as people shouted word from roof to roof. And then we heard a great roar and shouts of victory. "We've got the bridge!" the watchers shouted. "Ytra has taken the bridge!" The rest of the day, though there were alarms and setbacks, was a long turn of the tide. The Kassakarans giving way under Ytran assaults, trying to regroup, getting knocked apart again, seeking ways to retreat, and finding them blocked. Until by evening, the whole besieging army had become a horde of scattered men running for their lives through all the country between Ytra and the Moor, and the farmlands across the Nisus, chased by our mounted troops, hunted, cut down. The pig hunt, it was called later. Outside the walls, corpses were strewn thick over the earthworks and through the ravaged camp. Thousands of dead men, many already naked, stripped of arms and clothing by our soldiers. The Nisus was dammed in places by dead bodies. We were released after sunset. I went up on the parapet by the north gate and saw the live men moving among the corpses, heaving them about like dead sheep, to get at their armor and weapons, sometimes slashing a throat if the man seemed not certainly dead. Soon a call went out for slaves to bring the Ytran dead into the city to our pyres by the Ashbrook. We seven were sent on that duty and worked all night by moonlight and torchlight carrying corpses. It was an unearthly business. What I chiefly remember of it was that each time Anso and I, working together, laid a body down in the burning grounds, I thought of Salo's baby, Yavin's son, my nephew, who had lived an hour in the starving city. And each time I asked Enu to guide not the soldier, but that tiny, unmade soul into the fields of darkness and the fields of light. Many of the bodies we carried were those of city guards. They had paid a high cost for their brave foray. All that night there was a kind of feeble riot, as both citizens and slaves poured out the open gates to plunder the food stores of the Kassakaran army, and the Ytran soldiers posted to guard them gave way before the pleas and the press of starving people, many of whom they knew. Some soldiers even brought up supply wagons to bring grain into the city. People fought over the supplies, mobbing the grain carts. Order was established only when daylight came, and then only by the use of violence, whips, cudgels, swords. In the morning light I saw the horror on the soldiers' faces as they looked at their people, the men and women of their city, swarming over a rack of sheep carcasses like maggots on a dead rat. Slaves were ordered to their owner's house by noon on pain of death. So I left the Shrine of the Forefathers with only time to thank old Reba and to accept from Meeman his little handwritten copy of Caspro's poem. Don't let Avera see it, he said with his wry smile, and not knowing how to thank him, I only stammered, No, no, I won't. It was the first book I'd ever owned. It was the first thing I'd ever owned. I called what I wore my clothes. The desk I used in the schoolroom I called my desk. But in fact, they were not mine. They were the property of the House of Arca, as I was. But this book, this was mine. When Yavin came home, he greeted the father and mother with suitable affection and decorum and headed straight for the silk rooms. It was wonderful to see how Sallow bloomed and shone now that he was back. Yavin wasn't as thin as most city people were, but he'd been through hard times too and was weathered and toughened and tired. He told us about the campaign, me and Sallow and Sotur and Astano and Oko, all back in the schoolroom with Avera, like the old days. The forces of Morva had been reinforced by an army from Gallic. The Votizens and Oskins had joined them. Itra's army had been hard put to withstand attackers on so many fronts. There had been, Yavin thought, some mistakes, some confusion in command, but no betrayal. The Itrans could not come to the relief of their city till they defeated the enemies who would have followed them right to the walls. Then they came as fast as they could. They crossed the moor at night, making a boat bridge, so as to take the besieging army by surprise from the east, the unexpected direction. But we had no real idea how hard it was for you here, he said. I still can't imagine what it was like. Astano showed him a piece of famine bread she had kept, a brownish wafer like a chip of wood, made from a little barley or wheat meal, sawdust, earth, and salt. We had plenty of salt, she said. All we needed was something to put it on. Yavin smiled, but the grim lines were set in his face. We'll make Kasikar pay for this, he said.
Oh, said Sotur, pay? Are we merchants, then?
No, little cousin. We're soldiers.
And the wives of soldiers, and the lovers and mothers and sisters and cousins of soldiers. And what is it Kasikar will pay us?
It's how it is, Yavin said gently. His hand was on Sallow's hand as they sat side by side on the schoolroom bench. Avera spoke of the honor of the city, the insult to the power of the ancestors, the vengeance due. Yavin listened to him with us, but said nothing more of such matters. Presently he asked me about my time at the shrine and the ancient documents that we had been rescuing. As I was telling him, I saw in his absorbed face the face of the boy who loved the epics and the ballads, who had led us to build Sentos on those summer afternoons. It came into my head to wonder what Yavin would make of the new poets. Maybe someday, when he was father of Archimand and I was the teacher in this classroom, I would give him the transformations to read, and he would discover that new world. But I couldn't quite imagine it. Still, the thought moved me to tell him how we'd recited the bridge on the Nisus in the barrack early in the siege, how all the men had roared it out together, Beneath the walls of Itra! We ended up, all of us, in the schoolroom, reciting the ballads, with Yavin the lead voice, and some of my skinny little pupils crept in to listen, round-eyed and wondering at the tall soldier laughing as he declaimed, Then fled the Morvan soldiers. The men of Morva ran.
Again and again, Sotur whispered, and back and forth.
She was not saying the poems with us. She looked wretched and bewildered. She saw me gazing at her with concern and turned her head sharply away. Those autumn weeks after the siege, we enjoyed what may be the sweetest of all pleasures, relief from incessant, intense strain and fear. That relief, that release, is freedom made manifest. It lets the heart soar. A mood of lenience and kindness filled our command. People were grateful to one another that they had survived together. They could laugh together, and they did. Early in the winter, Torm came back to the house to live. He had been in the city all through the siege, but not at our command. The dictator had levied a special troop of cadets, soldiers, invalided home, and veterans as an auxiliary to the city guard, doing sentry duty, manning the walls and gates, and serving as firemen and civic police. These men had done good service in defense and fighting fires, and had at first been popular heroes. But their increasing role in punishing black marketers, hoarders, and suspected traitors had led people to fear their investigations and accuse them of using their power arbitrarily. They had been disbanded a few days after liberation when the dictator resigned, restoring full power to the Senate. Torm was 17 now, but looked much older, carrying himself and behaving like a grown man, grim, self-contained, and silent. He brought Hobie back to our command with him. As his own reward for service, he had requested that Hobie be released from the civic workforce to serve as his bodyguard. Like Metter, the father's bodyguard, Hobie slept outside his master's door. Though he still shaved his head and was a bigger man than Torm, their resemblance was clear to see. The occasion of Torm's return was Estano's betrothal ceremony. The mother had not approved her marriage with Korik Beltomo Runda, but instead had chosen for her a relative of that house through the female line, Renin Beltomo Tark. Tarkmand was an ancient, though not a wealthy house, and Renin a promising young senator. He was a good-looking fellow and a pleasant talker, though, according to Sallow, our principal informant, he didn't know anything.
Not even Trudic. Maybe he knows politics.
Sotur said nothing about the betrothal to us. We saw little of her. It seemed she hadn't felt the release from fear as we did. She hadn't regained her weight and looks as we all were doing. She still had the siege face. When I found her in the library, at the table with a book, she would greet me kindly, but wouldn't talk much, and very soon would slip away. My ache of desire for her was gone, turned to an ache of pity, with a tinge of impatience. Why must she go on moping in these good days of freedom? Vera was to deliver an address at the betrothal ceremony. He spent days getting all his quotations from the classics ready. In the benign mood of that autumn, I felt it mean and dishonorable to hide from my old teacher what I'd learned from Meeman and the others at the shrine. I told him I'd read Denios, and that Meeman had given me his copy of Caspro's Cosmologies. My teacher shook his head gravely, but didn't go into a tirade. That encouraged me to ask him how Denios' poems could corrupt a reader, since they were noble in both language and meaning.
"Discontent," Vera answered. "Noble words, to teach you how to be unhappy. Such poets refuse the gifts of the ancestors. Their work is a bottomless pit. Once you remove the firm foundation of belief on which all our lives are built, there is nothing. Only words. Gorgeous, empty words. You can't live on words, Gavir. Only belief gives life and peace. All morality is founded upon belief."
I tried to say what I thought I had glimpsed in Denios, a morality larger than the one we knew. But my ideas were mere gropings, and Avera demolished them with his certainty.
"He teaches nothing but rebellion against what must be, refusal of truth. Young men like to play with rebellion, to play at disbelief, I know that. But you'll tire of that sick folly as you grow older, and come back to belief, the one foundation of the moral law."
It was a relief to hear the old certainties again. and he hadn't told me to stop reading Caspero. I did not read often in the cosmologies, for it was difficult and seemed remote and strange to me. But sometimes lines from it, or from Denios, would come into my mind, unfolding their meaning or their beauty as a beech leaf unfurls in spring. I thought of one of those lines when I stood with all the household to watch Estano, wearing robes of white and silver, cross the great atrium to meet and welcome her husband-to-be. She is a ship on a flowing of bright waters. Vera made his speech, bristling with classical quotations, so that everyone could be impressed by the learning of the House of Arca. The mother of the House of Arca said the words that gave her daughter to the House of Tark. The mother of that house came forward to receive Aristano as the future mother of Tarkmand. Then my little pupils sang a wedding song Sotur had rehearsed with them for weeks. And so it was done. Lyre players and drummers in the gallery tuned up, and the well-born went to the great rooms to feast and dance. We house people had a feast too, and our own music and dancing in the back courtyard. It was cold and a little rainy, but we were ready to dance, and always ready to feast again. Betrothed in winter, Estano was married on the day of the spring equinox. A month later, Yavin was called back to his regiment. Itra was mounting an invasion of Kasikar. Votus, which had been part of the alliance with Morva against us, had come over to our side, fearing the power of Kasikar and seeing a chance to cripple it while it was weakened by defeat. Itrans and Votusans together would invade and take or besiege the city of Kasikar. A great city, sometimes our enemy, sometimes our ally.
Again and again, back and forth,
Sotur had said. I saw Sallow the day Yavin left. She had been allowed to go down to the river gate to see him and his troops march out to war amid the wild cheering of the people. She was not tearful. She had the same certain hope she had had for him all through the siege.
I think luck listens to him,
she said with a smile, but seriously.
In battle, I mean, in war. Not here.
Not here? What do you mean, Sal? We were in the library alone and could talk freely. Yet she hesitated for a long time. Finally, she looked up at me, and seeing I really had no idea what she meant, she said,
"The father was glad to see him go."
I protested.
"No, listen, truly, Gav."
She spoke very low, sitting close to me.
"The father hates Yavindi. He does. He's jealous. Yavin will inherit Altan Arka's power, his house, his seat in the Senate. And he's beautiful and tall and kind like his mother. He's a Gallico, not an Arka. His father can't bear to look at him. He's so jealous of him. I've seen it 100 times. Why do you think it's Yavin, the elder son, the heir, who gets sent off again to war, while the younger son, who should be the soldier, who's had all the fancy training to be a soldier, stays safe at home, with his bodyguard, the cowardly, pompous little adder?
I had never in my life heard my good-natured, tender-hearted sister speak with such hatred. I was appalled, wordless.
"Torm will be groomed for the Senate, you'll see,"
she said.
"Altan Arka hopes Yavin will be killed."
Her soft, passionate voice broke on that word, and she gripped my hand hard.
"He hopes it,"
she repeated in a whisper. I wanted to refuse and refute everything she said, but still no words came to me. Sotur came into the library. She stopped, seeing us, as if to withdraw. Sallow looked up at her and said in a plaintive whisper,
"Oh, Sotur Io."
And Sotur came to her and took her in her arms, a thing I had never seen that reticent, shy, proud girl do with anyone. The two clung to each other, as if trying to reassure each other, and unable to. I sat in dumb wonder. I tried to believe that they were consoling each other for losing Yavin, but I knew it wasn't that. It wasn't grief I saw, or love. It was fear. And when Sotur's eyes met mine over my sister's head, there was a fierce indignation in her look, which softened gradually. Whatever enemy she had been seeing in me, she saw me again at last. She said,
"Oh, Gavir, if you could get Avera to ask for Salo to help him teach the little ones, something, anything to get her out of the silk rooms. I know you can't, he can't, I know. I asked for her as my maid. I asked the mother for my name day present, just while Yavin is away. May I have Salo?" And she said no, it was not possible. I have never asked for anything. Oh, Salo, Salo, you must get sick. You must starve again. Get thin and ugly like me.
I didn't understand. Sotur couldn't comprehend my incomprehension. Salo did. She kissed Sotur's cheek and turned to me and hugged me, saying,
"Don't worry, Gav. It'll be all right, you'll see."
And she went off, back to the chambers of the Wellborn and the silk rooms, and I went back to the slave barrack, puzzled and worried, but always coming back to the belief, the sure belief, that the father and mother and ancestors of our house would not let anything go really wrong.